Welcome to the Competent Pastor Podcast.
A podcast by pastors for pastors that starts with one question.
What is the most important skill of a competent pastor?
We're your hosts. I'm Michael Danner.
And I'm Rachel Ringenberg-Miller.
Today we're thrilled to talk with Reverend Dr. Sarah Ann Bixler. Sarah is the Associate Dean of Eastern Mennonite Seminary and teaches formation and practical theology at Eastern Mennonite University in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Sarah holds a PhD in practical theology and an MDiv from Princeton Theological Seminary, and she has a BA in English education from Eastern Mennonite University. Her scholarship explores attachment theory and adolescent belonging in faith communities. Sarah, along with her spouse Benjamin and their three children, are engaged in restorative work at their historic farm in the Shenandoah Valley, a former plantation established by President Lincoln's great uncle. They attend Parkview Mennonite Church.
Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So first, we want to hear from you where you are currently, and also, why are you interested, why do you care about pastors and pastoral ministry?
So I'm the Associate Dean of the Seminary at Eastern Mennonite University in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and I also teach information and practical theology here. So much of my work is with persons who are already in pastoral ministry or who are training for it, which is approximately half of our seminary population. So this is something I think about on a daily basis, and I think it's so important. So I care deeply about the formation of persons who will lead and guide and walk alongside others in congregations.
And when you say formation, what does that look like at EMS?
So I understand formation as this dynamic process of being formed by things that might be external to us, and also of intentional behaviors and postures where we seek to form ourselves as well. So for instance, something that we do a lot of in our courses at Eastern Mennonite Seminary is to try out and to explore spiritual practices. These are ways that we can intentionally posture ourselves to hear from God, to notice what God is doing in the world, and to experience God's presence within ourselves as well. We also reflect on the ways that communities and experiences in life impact us and shape us as well. And so it's this dynamic process of engaging in intentional things that we hope will shape us into people God is calling us to be, and also reflecting on some things that might be out of our control that impact us as well.
All right, so now we're going to jump into the question that we ask every guest, which we prompted you on. So in your opinion, what is the most important skill of a competent pastor?
I think the most important skill is called mind sight. So this is a technical term, and it comes to us from an intersection of psychology and neuroscience. And I'm going to explain it because it's really something that has brought together a number of things that were intuitive for me in my own years of pastoral ministry, and also things that I didn't quite understand what they were or skills, how to get them, but I sensed that I needed them and I needed more understanding. So for me and my experience in ministry and my studies, this is something that draws together a number of important skills for pastoral ministry. So mind sight, according to a clinical professor of psychiatry, Daniel Siegel, is a term for both how we see our own minds and the minds of others, and our ability to honor differences while remaining connected. So the mind is not merely brain activity. It's this interrelational process, an embodied process of the ways that energy flows within and between people. And our brain is what tends to regulate and interpret that flow of energy and information. So mind sight is seeing or perceiving or trying to understand what's going on in my mind and what's going on in someone else's as well. It's about empathy. It's about insight. It's about recognizing difference and maintaining connection. And mindset has three movements to it, according to Dan Siegel, that I think are really important for pastors to practice. They all start with the letter O: openness, observation, and objectivity. So openness, as we know from our own experiences of spirituality and life in the world, is about being present, noticing what's happening right now, and hopefully trying to notice that without judgments that so often jump into our minds, right? Maybe I should say, especially in pastoral ministry, where we hold particular norms and expectations for ourselves and for life and community. Certain things we read in scripture about character and how we're supposed to function in the body of Christ. Openness is simply noticing what's happening right now and holding it without judgment or suspending our judgment as we are open to it and notice it. It's about the ability to be present and to focus on our immediate experience. The second O of mindsight is observation. So we're going to take one step back from the openness. And here we're going to be curious about, where is this coming from? Where is this experience arising from? So maybe I'm having some really big feelings, or I'm noticing some strong emotions in someone else. I'm open to them, and now I'm going to explore what might that be coming from. A bit of a broader perspective on this flow of energy within and between us. It's about a sense of curiosity and knowing that can come when we're not swept up in the immediacy of the experience. Then there's a third step yet, also starts with O, where we take one more step back, and it's called objectivity. I have a little bit of a problem with this word because as a practical theologian, I don't actually think there is really objectivity. Yeah. We're all subjects and we interpret things from our own position in the world, our own experiences. But in the practice of mindsight, objectivity simply means another step back from openness and observation. It's not that we're so distant that we lose our personal viewpoint, but it's recognizing that what we see and experience is not all there is. It's not the total reality. It's also not the all there is to someone else and their identity. It's also not all there is to ourselves as well. So objectivity is about recognizing that feelings and emotions, immediate sensations, are like moments in time. They don't totally define us or anyone else. And so this practice of mindsight, openness, observation, objectivity is about seeing and knowing the mind of oneself and another for the purposes of empathy and remaining connected.
Yeah, thanks for that deep, lovely description. It was also kind of making me go back, and we've talked about this before, Sarah. So I'm an alum of Eastern Mennonite Seminary. And one of the things that that sticks with me are these reflection papers that we had to write one a week for 3 years. And my joke was that by the time I was graduating, I was sick with myself. I was done. I didn't want to be with myself anymore. But it is so valuable to spend all that time trying to pay attention to what's going on with yourself. How does that look like coming out? Mm-hmm. And then when do you need to shift and change based upon, you know, what's going on with you and who you're talking with. So that leads me to my question for you then as a follow-up. So can you give an example of when you did this work well and an example of when you didn't do this work so well, right? Because it's hard. It's a practice.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So as I mentioned, mindset is something that I've been studying and learning about as a tool or an understanding, a frame of reference that I wish I had, mm-hmm. But that I did not have. So for instance, I'm thinking about the congregational processes that I was part of when I was a youth minister. And sometimes in congregational processes, whatever the decision might have been, I can think of examples of we were making staffing decisions. We were making decisions about building projects. We were making decisions about committee membership, for instance. In these congregational processes, sometimes, interestingly, people will complain that protocols aren't being followed, or we didn't do it this way before, for instance. A response that would practice mindsight would be able to move beyond a posture of defensiveness, which I absolutely have been defensive before, by saying, well, yes, we are following this process, or perhaps saying, well, it doesn't apply in this case. We're doing something new. We don't have a pattern for this. But instead of getting defensive and argue over whether or not protocol was followed, for instance, in a congregational process, as we practice mindsight, we can begin to dig down even deeper and to be curious about, to imagine what might be leading to this behavior of critique that we're observing. So for instance, is there maybe a need that's important here that's not being met? So I wish that I would have been able to interpret complaints about congregational process as a need for clarity, a need for honesty, a need for communication, instead of becoming defensive and feel that it was an attack on me for not doing my job well, for instance. And then as we discover what might underlie some of this flow of energy that we are feeling, there's opportunity to make requests of one another, to take responsibility, to consider how we might be able to meet those needs in the future for clarity, for honesty, for good communication, for instance.
So how about a time it didn't go well?
Oh, I thought that's what I was describing. Where I was defensive and couldn't interpret it. I guess I kind of included both the what didn't go well, but I wished I would have done differently. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In your experience.
Do you want me to describe a little bit of, one or the other?
It's okay.
I followed you. Followed you, Sarah. It's just Michael.
Okay. It's just me. I was over here. Yeah, well, and it's so easy to get tripped up, like, on defensiveness, like, in that first posture of openness, especially for pastors that feel like any critique is personal, but also maybe even threatening to job stability, all that kind of stuff. How do you help people, especially students you're working with, think about what kind of prompts do you use when you start to feel that in yourself, like, to mm-hmm. that you're being defensive, you're starting to take that the wrong way. You've read an email, now you're mad and you start typing. Like, how do you help people or think through that or process it?
So one of the first steps is, again, to be able to slowly and gently walk ourselves back a couple of steps in observation. Mm-hmm. So here, something that I find helpful and that I practice with students, actually, we were just practicing it this week in class, in formation and ministry class, is to acknowledge critiques that hurt, that feel very personal, whether they're intended to be or not, and to name some of those criticisms that we're most afraid of hearing. And then to be able to start recognizing us as different from the critique. So when I receive a critique, I might have experienced some kind of a negative emotion. Sometimes, as we were talking about it in class, one of those emotions is fear. Like you mentioned, Michael, my job's at stake. So if I'm not well-liked as a pastor, I might not be here. And then what will I do and where will I go? So a first acknowledgement, let's say we're experiencing fear as we receive this criticism, is to move from letting that define ourselves, I am afraid, to feeling it, which is like one step back. I feel fear, and notice that difference. I'm turning fear into something that's just a little bit distanced from my own identity. And then the third step back is I am aware of feeling fear. So it's this subtle shift. And again, it can take a little bit of time in prayer and in silence to feel the feeling and then to be aware that we're feeling it and to differentiate ourselves from that feeling. And then with that little bit of distance, I think we're able to then start to get underneath of this. Why do I feel fear when this comment comes up? What's important to me that feels like it might be under threat? And once we can get a sense of our own, those needs that are giving rise to our own feelings, we can then start to practice empathy for someone else. And why might they have made this comment? What do they need or value that they're apparently not receiving in the sermon that I preached, for instance?
Right, because most of the time, I mean, there are some critiques that are obviously about you and you need to work through as a pastor, but sure. Sometimes it's actually not. And so kind of what I hear from you is kind of that, wait 24 hours before you respond and then do some of that work that you just described. It's more than just like, let me just wait to respond. It's also, I'm going to wait and respond and do some of the self work so that when I do respond, I've kind of shifted through all the feelings within my body and then able to go ahead and move forward with this person and hopefully a more healthy way than I might have otherwise.
Right. And it takes time. It's hard to do this focused work within ourselves. It's interesting now because when I read the Gospels with this particular lens of thinking about mindset, I imagine Jesus doing something like this a lot. Mm-hmm. Well, think of all the critiques that he received, all of the judgment that was placed upon him, all of the resistance and pushback to his ministry. We see him going to a secluded place a lot. We see him rising early to engage in prayer. It takes an enormous amount of inner resources to continue showing up day after day in ministry the way that Jesus did, to remain present to other people and to practice compassion. And I think that he was cultivating that inner strength in that time that he spent alone. And he was always looking for it. Sometimes the crowds followed him so much and he had to postpone it for a little bit, but he did not give up on that practice. And in some of the most crucial moments of his ministry that we read about in the Gospels, we see that he's taking that time to do that work in the presence of God in solitude.
The other thing I noticed is a lot of the people that were encountering Jesus were actually in the kind of response would be the opposite of what you're talking about, where they're threatened by him as one who preaches with authority or something he's teaching. Somehow they feel some sort of a threat to the system, to themselves, to their position, and they start coming at him, even obviously trying to kill him, mm-hmm. which might be the opposite of mind sight.
I think so.
I talk about it sometimes as like empathetic Bible reading. It's like putting yourself in the position of like all the people that were even the people that were coming at him. I'd be like, I mean, I get that. Like if I were in that role, perhaps like these are human folks dealing with the same emotions we would have in these kind of situations. And yet, yeah, he did definitely respond to it quite a lot different and more empathetically than probably we do sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting.
And he gave it back sometimes. Mm-hmm. I don't want to minimize that. We don't get a totally, purely nonviolent picture of Jesus from the Gospels as much as we might want to look for that as Mennonites. He said some mean things, and he acted out with physical force sometimes. Mm-hmm. But his deep underlying value of justice and of proclaiming release for the captives, I think we definitely see in his ministry. And his attention to people who were marginalized and who were being oppressed by those who were in power, I think was made possible and sustained by that continuing time that he spent alone.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories of Jesus to share, to talk about with other pastors, you know, is that, you know, after the feeding of the 5,000, then Jesus is trying to like get away, right? And so eventually he sends the disciples off in their boat and he's like, see you later, guys. And then he goes. And what I think is super fascinating about this story is that when the disciples see Jesus the next day, they don't recognize him. He looks like a ghost. And of course, there's multiple ways to interpret the story. But when I think about what we're talking about now, I think about how like perhaps he was so exhausted and so tired that when they saw Jesus refreshed and ready to go again, like they didn't recognize him, because there's also a physical change in you when you take that opportunity to do some self-reflection and to care for yourself. You do just physically look different. And so I just kind of wonder sometimes, you know, why did they think he looked like a ghost? Was it that he, you know, finally had that time away?
And he was walking on water.
I mean, he was also walking on water. That's a very important piece of the story, too.
Strolling across
that would freak me out a little bit. But what I think I would recognize either one of you if you're walking on water.
Yeah, I'll stick to flipping tables. I can actually do that.
Yeah, but I do. I think how many times in pastoral ministry do we just continue to go and go and push ourselves and continue to respond to requests and to seeming needs that are immediate and do so out of a place of depletion? We should take our pastoral responsibilities seriously. And there are times where we need to set aside our own needs temporarily in order to respond to a crisis. Mm-hmm. That's our role. But if we continue to function in patterns where our energy is depleted, that will lead us to burnout. And we saw so much of this, didn't we, during the COVID pandemic? Mm-hmm. And we have so many persons in pastoral ministry who continue to leave the pastorate because of the burnout. We need practices that can sustain us so that our functioning in times of crisis doesn't become our pattern of functioning for longer periods of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that makes me think about kind of a disconnect that I hear from pastors and then what they experience in their congregation. So that in seminary, they learn that, yeah, they need to take that time, this mindset, like I got to set my boundaries and be ready so I can fully enter into this ministry. But then when these pastors say, okay, congregation, I need some time away, or I'm not able to come to this event, et cetera, et cetera. The congregation is like, what? Like we're paying you to be here. How can you tell me no. And that is like something that I see or I hear quite often. And I'm just curious, like if you were to talk with a congregation, or what, how would you respond if you found yourself in that kind of situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an excellent observation. And it's so true. I have students who are currently serving in pastoral ministry and seminary right now, and they bring this up all the time. I have suggested to my congregation that Monday is my Sabbath, and I keep getting calls. And so also feeling like there aren't folks in the congregation who really understand that important need. I think that our entire culture in congregational life needs an orientation around rest and renewal and action. Mm-hmm. And when we, so the pastor's time and boundaries are one aspect of this. We also have another whole aspect in congregational life that's committee work and congregational meetings and expectations of volunteers. And we also have programming that we offer, and often we create more programs and don't do the hard discerning work of, do we have the bandwidth for this? Mm-hmm. And if we add this, is there something else that we're going to let go because that's no longer central to the work, to the missional work that we feel called to in this particular time and place? So for me, I like to think about this and encourage my students as well to think about it as a whole culture of, we might say, Sabbath keeping across congregational life. So it's not just the pastor trying to protect the boundaries carefully of when to have time off, but there's actually consideration for how does our entire congregation function according to these patterns of renewal and of activism.
Yeah, I've noticed a lot of, like when I was conference minister especially, a lot of congregational cultures were really shaped by unhealth at pastor, like unrealistic expectations, and also pastors who felt like their job was just to be doing everything all the time. Oftentimes when they got paired with an associate pastor who had some self-awareness and some boundaries, they would be in conflict within about 3 months. It happened like clockwork. It's like, this person isn't coming in on Saturday because it's their day off, but we need them to fold the bulletins or whatever. You know, that's a silly example, but that kind of thing where we've conditioned whole congregational systems to actually expect unhealth out of the pastors by the way pastors have responded and the way they've approached ministry. So what you're saying is really helpful, like, and really hopeful that folks are learning how to do this. But there are, it's also hard to change, like, congregational culture. Like, and,
yep.
Yeah. One and of the,
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. And if I am feeling like I'm giving 150% in my work or in my volunteerism in the congregation or in my ministry, it actually can feel threatening. Mm-hmm. Have someone else who's trying to create boundaries and mm-hmm. differentiating themselves from that unhealthy system. Mm-hmm. And so there can definitely be a lot of pushback mm-hmm. to this from people who, again, if we take a couple of steps back, have deep unmet needs for rest themselves, and they have been pushing themselves and so expect everybody around them mm-hmm. To live that sacrificially as well.
One of the shifts we made, it was last year, right, Rachel, to mm-hmm. the pastor salary guidelines is redefined the expectation of the work week for the pastor, which had read for, I'm guessing, forever. Time and eternity since Moses came down off the mountain.
Exactly.
You worked 45 to 50 hours a week was what it said.
Yes,
we,
it did.
We shifted that to 40. And mm-hmm. frankly, there were some people that lost mm-hmm. their minds like mm-hmm. in the emails we got, like,
well, and I'm actually still working with folks on that, right?
Yeah.
So there's this idea that a pastor also volunteers their time as well. They're a volunteer just like the congregation people volunteer. And so that's like a boundary setting, right, for the pastor and for the congregation to learn that there is a different relationship going on. but it's also very hard to shift culture, as Michael's saying.
I'm curious, can you give us so let's say your pastor's got this practice, they're working, you know, at MindSight, they're doing these three steps. What are the benefits, tangible benefits to a whole community when a pastor functions that way? What does that church look like, perhaps? Mm-hmm. Like, make a case for why pastors should dive into this.
Yeah. So first of all, it provides congregations with a pastor who can be better attentive to their needs. So perhaps ironically, the more attentive we are to ourselves, not the more selfish we become, but the more empathetic we become. So there's a shift there that I believe happens, that the quality of the pastoral care goes up, and also the ability to navigate conflict increases as well. So again, whenever the pastor or hopefully others in the congregation as well are working on this, are doing this internal work, it can actually help to diffuse some of the tension that escalates when none of us are at our best and when we are out of touch with ourselves. It also can create a rising conflict, though, first, right? Because anytime in a system one person does something differently, it's going to unsettle the expected behaviors and the patterns that had been going on. So this is hard work. When the pastor takes a differentiated stand, mm-hmm. it can unsettle people. And so again, there are definitely benefits to this kind of a posture. But as you said, it really is about an entire cultural shift from the ways that I'm afraid many of our congregations set up expectations for our pastoral leader. Yeah.
It's a very, you know, beautiful and hopeful way of looking at congregational ministry. And I think, too, gets to this idea, especially from an Anabaptist perspective, that we're all doing ministry together, right? Like, the pastor is an important piece, right? But they're not the only ones doing ministry, right? Ministry happens between two people, at least, or two or three are gathered, sort of a thing. So I like how we're talking about the whole system there.
Yeah. One question that came to mind. And so how does this then, how do you, within this framework, how do you then step into those situations where actually there's harm being done by a congregational member, some accountability needs to happen. Sometimes I will see pastors that they love the openness and the non-judgment and the observation stuff. And then it's like, yeah, but you actually have to do something about that. Like, mm-hmm. Where does that fit in? Or how does this even help shape how you work at accountability within the congregation, especially in the cases where there's harm being done or any of those kinds of things, injustice kind of stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm envisioning this process as something that gets us to the point where that excellent work of discernment for appropriate action is possible.
Okay.
So when we are in the midst of being swept up in our emotions, our reactions, our feelings of being threatened or afraid, we're not able to clearly discern where harm has occurred, what obligations might have been created by those harms, what needs were violated or continue to go unmet. So when we're able to take a bit of this perspective in stepping back a little bit, that's where we have the clarity for the discernment to happen. And so it's really, you could say MindSight prepares you for action and responsibility taking. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Okay. So somebody listens to this, they're like, I'm down with Sarah. How do I learn this? Is there stuff that, is there stuff at EMS, at short courses mm-hmm. that can audit degree programs, kind of plug opportunities for folks to actually learn more about this? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the courses that I love to teach so much at Eastern Mennonite Seminary are in our formation sequence. Rachel, we don't quite have people writing weekly reflections.
I mean, that's probably fine.
as you might remember them in years past. But we do a lot of reflective work. And so in our formation classes, in addition to myself and other professors who are trained in some of these methods, we also have spiritual directors and persons who are in active ministry serving as small group leaders to further give opportunity for reflective processes for practicing this. So that's an option in the graduate space. And our formation courses can be taken for credit as part of degree programs. They can be audited as well. But we also have short opportunities, webinars, evening lectures, workshops that are a couple of hours in length, both on our campus and offered online by a new initiative at Eastern Mennonite Seminary called the Shalom Collaboratory, because we believe these practices promote a sense of wholeness and peace, and that is what God is calling us to in our communities of faith. And so those opportunities are listed at emu.edu/shalom.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah, for listing all that out. And maybe when we put in her bio or the description, we can drop that link in there too, so people can find it and they can kind of continue this work.
It'll be in the show notes.
It'll be in the show notes, yes. Yes. Well, thanks, Sarah, so much for joining us. It's so fun to talk with you and hear all the things that you're thinking about and, you know, help us to think about what does it mean to be a pastor within Mennonite Church USA. So thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. My pleasure.